there is stigma and shame attached to it. I mean, a series of reasons why they don't come early enough. And so we do see a lot of late cases.
A new report documents the rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping and methodical. This is Tuesday, December 12th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You are part of this program. Join us on any of our VOA Asia social media platforms. Also ahead, the UN Security Council holds its annual gathering to denounce human rights in North Korea. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Stay with us. The rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping, and it's been methodical. That is the finding of an Associated Press news agency report after interviewing 29 women and girls who fled to neighboring Bangladesh. The survivors from several refugee camps were interviewed separately. The women gave AP their names but agreed to be publicly identified only by their first initial, citing fears they or their families would be killed by Myanmar's military. They ranged in age from 13 to 35, came from a wide swath of villages in Myanmar's Rakhine State, and described assaults between October 2016 and mid-September. One of those interviewed said the attacks were swift. She said 50 people from the military, 50 men came into the village, surrounded it, and stood in front of people's doors in groups of threes. They then entered into the homes and started pulling out young girls from their homes. They began raping them, and some came toward me and started beating me up. The testimonies bolster the UN's contention that Myanmar's armed forces are systematically employing rape as a calculated tool of terror aimed at exterminating the Rohingya people. The report found what it calls a sickening sameness to their stories, with distinct patterns in their accounts, their assailants' uniforms, and the details of the rapes themselves. The Myanmar Armed Forces did not respond to multiple requests from the AP for comment, but an internal military investigation last month concluded that none of the assaults ever took place. The AP report said, however, that they are stunned at the sheer volume of rapes and suspect only a fraction of women have come forward. Doctors Without Borders emergency medical coordinator Crystal Van Leeuwen said she expects many more rapes than those already reported have most likely occurred.
Since the 25th of August, in our facilities, which, you know, we're in the camp in 15 or so different locations, we've seen 94 women come forward for care of some sort related to sexual violence. The majority of the women are reporting that this occurred in Myanmar before they crossed in, and the stories that they're telling us, and that not only the victims themselves, but that other people are telling us about witnessing acts of sexual violence in Myanmar, make us feel that we're only capturing a very small proportion of the victims.
And that, says Leeuwen, is leading to treatment that is coming too late for many.
There's stigma and shame attached to it. I mean, a series of reasons why they don't come early enough. And so we do see a lot of late cases. The majority come after physical injuries may have already healed, that we've missed the window of opportunity to provide the prophylaxis for sexually transmitted infections and HIV. And we do see some women presenting with pregnancy-related concerns, seeking medical care for pregnancy, and that pregnancy was a result of rape.
The AP report adds that although the scale of these attacks is new, the use of sexual violence by Myanmar security forces is not. Before she became Myanmar's civil leader, Aung San Suu Kyi herself said Myanmar's armed forces used rape as a weapon to intimidate ethnic nationalities. These are among the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. China fails to block a UN meeting on North Korea human rights. The U.S., South Korea, and Japan start a missile tracking drill. A Bangladeshi man with a homemade bomb strapped to his body set off an explosion at a New York commuter hub during rush hour Monday morning, wounding himself and three others. And China's leader launches an investment deal in Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOAnews.com website. The United Nations Security Council met on Monday to discuss human rights abuses in North Korea. The U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, said if we truly care about prevention, human rights has to be at the heart of it. VOA U.N. correspondent Margaret Bashir joins us from the United Nations now. Tell us more about this, Margaret.
So, Ira, this is an annual exercise. It's become an annual exercise discussing the human rights situation in North Korea in the Security Council. Now, that's not the normal venue for human rights discussions at the UN. Usually they're either in committees related to the General Assembly or in Geneva at the Human Rights Council. So some council members have an issue with bringing this subject into the council, and others, the majority, say it's important because you can't separate human rights and conflict prevention.
So what was discussed?
So we have the Human Rights High Commissioner for Human Rights, Prince Zayed Raad Al Hussein, and he spoke about a number of things, but really one of the big issues he's concerned about is the impact of economic sanctions on ordinary citizens in North Korea. He wasn't advocating the repealing of those sanctions necessarily. He was just saying that the Security Council should perhaps periodically take a look at them and assess them and make sure they're not hurting North Koreans who are already struggling to get by.
The humanitarian assistance provided by UN agencies and others is literally a lifeline for some 13 million acutely vulnerable individuals. But sanctions may be adversely affecting this essential help. For example, controls over international banking transfers have caused a slowdown in UN ground operations affecting the delivery of food rations, health kits, and other humanitarian aid. I ask that members of this council conduct an assessment of the human rights impact of sanctions and that conduct or that action be taken to minimize their adverse humanitarian consequences.
Now, there were just a couple, two or three, I think, I do believe, countries, members of the UN Security Council that expressed some kind of opposition to all this.
Right. So since this started in 2014, this move to bring human rights into the Security Council, China has regularly tried to block the meeting, and they do that through a procedural vote. So it's a lot of, UN sort of theatrics, and there's a vote, but they always lose it, and then the meeting goes ahead. So it was China, Russia, and Bolivia that objected to the meeting. Ethiopia and Egypt also abstained in the vote, so they were kind of neither here nor there. But you just need a majority of members to have the meeting, and so it went ahead.
Does this have any immediate effect on the world situation?
No, it doesn't, but it shines a spotlight on the issue, which, is getting buried behind the nuclear issue. And that was what one of the other briefers mentioned, that, don't obscure human rights. Don't let it get obscured by the attention that's being placed on security and political and issues right now. And I think that's important. And yesterday, Sunday, was International Human Rights Day, so it's sort of tagged around that on the calendar.
Now, also at the UN headquarters in New York, outside of the Security Council, there was something else happening dealing with Korea. Is that correct?
That's right. The United States and six other countries co-hosted a meeting about human rights in North Korea, and they brought a defector to speak at the meeting, a woman named Ji Hun Na, and she was caught three times trying to escape from North Korea from the time she was a teenager, and she had, horrible experiences in North Korean jails, and she was sent to a re-education center, and she was forced to undergo an abortion. I mean, she just had all sorts of human rights, gross violations of her human rights, but she's, an amazing success story because on her fourth attempt to get out of North Korea, she did it, and she made her way to China and eventually to South Korea, and today she's an activist and an author, and there are 30,000 people who have left North Korea successfully since the mid-1990s, since the famine, and made it to South Korea. And so she's now one of them. And one of the issues she really focused on is the concern about forcibly repatriating people who escape North Korea, that if they make it out, the Chinese should not send them back. And that's what China does. The South Koreans don't, obviously, but China does. And the High Commissioner for Human Rights said that in the past year, his office has received more than 70 reports of North Koreans who escaped to China and were returned home after the authorities there ruled that they were economic migrants.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's UN correspondent. Thanks for being with us, Margaret, from New York.
Thanks, Ira.
Happening now in Asia, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, said in an interview that the full U.S. Olympic team would participate in the Winter Games to be held in South Korea in February. However, she again left open the possibility that heightened security concerns could force the U.S. to reconsider the commitment. The rape of Rohingya women by Myanmar security forces has been sweeping and methodical, according to a report by the Associated Press. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. After dominating industries like textiles, electronics, and mobile phones, powerhouse China is setting its sights on a new sector. Experts predict that by 2020, the country will rank just behind Spain as the world's biggest wine market, fueled by both domestic production and foreign imports. That means training Chinese students to cultivate their palates and their business acumen, as Lisa Bryant reports for VOA from Dijon, the capital of the East Burgundy region.
This afternoon's class at the School of Wine and Spirits in Dijon, France, offers a virtual tour of winemaking in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and California.
So great varieties, Sauvignon Blanc, I've just said.
There is one country that is not covered, at least not yet. China, home to nearly one-third of the student body here at the School of Wine and Spirits Business.
Okay, so here is the map of New Zealand. What do you need?
Lei Shu wants to become a wine buyer for a Chinese company.
Actually, the wine culture in China now is not very good because most people, they don't know how to taste the wines. But so we still have the long way to do and to teach the Chinese people how to taste the wines, how to enjoy our wines.
Cabernet Merlot, very important. Merlot, this is one cost.
Students here are learning about every aspect of the wine business. For Chinese like Shu, they have plenty of work ahead.
They want to go back home with the best practice in order to be able to produce the best wines they can.
Director Jérôme Gallo runs a wine school, which is part of the Burgundy School of Business in Dijon.
And probably in a decade or two decades, Chinese, some of them will be alumni of our programs, Chinese people will be able to produce very qualitative wines at a large scale.
China is not just producing wine, it's also a big wine importer. Rich Chinese are snapping up French vineyards, mostly in the southwestern Bordeaux region. But Chinese tourists are also heading to Burgundy to sip and buy bottles from another prestige region. Dijon wine merchant Adrien Tirelli says he tries to share his passion about wines.
Chinese people, like all the new consumers, just learn in the guide. And then they come with the books and they tell me, I want this one, this one, this one. Perhaps like the Americans 15 years ago.
It seems only a matter of time before China will be the next star of this New World wines class. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Dijon, France.
And that's going to wrap up our program for this day. You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and on SoundCloud. You can download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you and find us at voanews.com. Let's hear from you as well. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to Director Tracy Carter, our engineer Jimmy Cook, the managing editor of VOA Asia, Diane Gao, the VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, David Byrd, Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a marvelous day ahead.